Welcome to In Context on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming live at WPKN.org. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. You can hear In Context every Monday from noon to 1 p.m., except the first Monday of the month when WPKN's general manager, Steve, reports to listeners. Our website is incontextreport.com. You can check us out on Facebook and see our videos on YouTube on our channel, In Context Radio and TV. And you can contact us through Facebook, Twitter, or email me directly at ken@mdrtalk.org. In today's program, we're going to take a look at two important means of influencing public opinion in nominally democratic countries, the schooling system and the mass media. In the first half of the show, we examine the early history of American education and its transformation into the modern compulsory school system, and we consider how this transformation of schooling impacts American society. In the second half of the program, we discuss the techniques of mass media propaganda, from its origins in World War I to modern times. To help us understand the history of American schooling and its implications for society, we begin with my 2009 interview with educator and author John Taylor Gatto. Mr. Gatto taught for 30 years in the New York City public school system and was selected as Teacher of the Year for both New York City and New York State. He's the author of Dumbing Us Down and the Underground History of American Education. Could you take us back in time and describe how Americans were educated in the colonial era and the early years of the American Republic?
Sure. The best reference for this would be two books, both very famous. One, the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin, and the other would be a gloriously written survey of America by a French aristocrat, Alexis de Tocqueville, called Democracy in America. They will be in every library in the United States. If you spend some time with both, you'll discover, A, that childhood hardly existed, that it existed up to the age of about seven, and after that, people were not only expected to carry their share of the load, but they were trusted to do that. So Ben Franklin, not from a wealthy family at all, from a family of, I believe, 15 kids, candlemaker as a father, was traveling back and forth to England and the continent in his early teen years. He also was working 60-hour week, and in addition to that, with his friends, putting themselves through an education at the age of about 12, that I believe Yale and Harvard would be reluctant to try to force on their own undergraduates today.
Did he have any formal schooling?
Franklin had 2 years of it. He was thrown out of both schools he attended because he was a bad boy. What that translates into is that he couldn't stand the limitation of opportunity that schooling offered, and the truth is, back in those days, very few people could. School would occupy, 90 days a year, and a maximum of 2 hours in a seat. Now, it was nothing at all like what we have today, and there was quite a palette of different types of schooling available, but I would say the American ideal, regardless of the social class, was self-schooling. The idea was that you could undertake your own education and no one would give it to you. You would take it by examining your own talents, your own weaknesses, and then matching those things up to opportunities to learn in the culture. It's very much like the unschoolers in the homeschooling community today. They trust their kids, and if someone listening is skeptical, let me tell you that the head of the Human Genome Project, Francis Collins, was an unschooler who studied whatever he felt like studying for as long as he felt like studying it. His mother only insisted that his other three brothers, all different ages, had to agree what the four of them would study. Other than that, she stayed out of the way. He shot through Harvard, with star performance and shot to the top of the scientific world. There can't be a project in Science Today that's even close in terms of prestige.
So Ben Franklin's schooling in the 18th century was not atypical. A lot of people would have had his type of education.
Oh, a great many. In fact, if you read his autobiography, you'll see that whatever Franklin did, most of his friends were doing too. I mean, they would sometimes join together. One of the things they did was they figured out that if you couldn't hold an audience communicating in writing, that you were in a lot of trouble where maximum opportunity was concerned. And they came to the conclusion that having a style that would grasp a reader's attention and hold it was important. So where were they going to get a style? Well, they picked the best stylists of the day, and they created this project for themselves. I would urge somebody listening to do this with their own kid today. They would try to rewrite an essay by someone with a good style in their own words until a third party looking at it would say, oh, you must have taken this from the New Yorker, you know, or some other high-style publication. And then they would realize that they had mastered style A, style B, style C. The autobiography is full of similar suggestions. When they were learning science, they actually did real scientific experiments. Nowhere in the United States today does that happen in a school. Even in the famous science schools, what happens is you imitate an experiment that everybody knows what the result's going to be. I mean, we're training clerks in the sciences rather than scientists.
Well, this form of schooling was later eclipsed, and you traced the origin of the modern American school system to a Napoleonic battle that took place in Europe in 1806. Could you please explain?
Sure. First, I think it's important that your listeners understand that Napoleon's armies were amateur armies. Germany, northern Germany, the military state of Prussia, was quite unlike that. Everybody lifted their fork at the same time, so they were used to winning all their battles. And when Napoleon menaced Prussia, it was assumed that it would be an open and shut victory for Prussia. Instead, Napoleon's armies at the Battle of Jena, that's J-E-N-A, in 1806, wiped out the Prussian army. That was a lot more important than simply losing a battle, because the chief cash income of the state of Prussia was renting out soldiers to other countries, and you can't get a good price for your soldiers if they get whipped by an amateur like Napoleon. So at that moment, a national panic ensued. And a famous philosopher from the University of Berlin, Johann Fichte, that's spelled F-I-C-H-T-E, demanded publicly of the Prussian king that this never happen again. He said this happened because people thought for themselves. And he suggested, in fact, demanded a new institution of universal forced schooling where everyone would be on the page that the boss wanted them to be on. And after years and years of this kind of drill and testing, the army would dependably follow the orders it was given. Prussia pulled it off by marching the kids to school at bayonet point, and as a consequence, turning lives into human resources. And a leader then can focus the human resources, confident that there'll be no contradictions. That works with a factory economy. Does not work to give the majority of people good lives, but it does work to build wealth and to give great wealth to the leadership, the management.
So the education is oriented towards the interest of the state, not towards the interest of the individual
student.
The
interest of the state and also the interests of the dominant economy, making it more efficient. When Prussian schooling came to the United States big time, it was brought here by Andrew Carnegie, John D. Rockefeller, Vincent Astor, Harriman. I mean, they front some poor chump named Horace Mann, who loved the Prussians, just loved them. But in fact, Mann was a politician who had no interest whatsoever in children or schooling. He was promised a seat in the American Congress if he could pull off forced schooling, and he did, and he got his seat in Congress.
Well, now, Horace Mann was a Massachusetts politician and lawyer. He was patronized by these industrialists. Did they send him to Prussia?
They sent him to Prussia. He dawdled on the way over, and when he got there, the schools were closed. So he was now faced with the prospect of returning to his backers in Massachusetts saying, sorry, I goofed up. No, he didn't do that. He came back and he said that what he had seen was paradise on earth. It was a utopia. You can read what he said in his seventh letter to the Boston school community. And he says, we must have Prussian schooling, which, of course, he had never seen.
Well, now, this is back in 1843, and then, as I understand it, he set to work with some of the industrialists and leading politicians to try to enact a law.
Peabody was the first one. The use of children in the industrial phase of America's history was critical. It was essential. And Peabody was a very large railroad magnate, and also he owned a number of coal mines. So the railroads and the coal mines, they worked in tandem. The major force of coal miners in the United States, I know this will strike some of your listeners as bizarre, but it was small children, because the tunnels, the coal-bearing tunnels, were so small that 8 and 9 year old children, boys and girls, were the ideal people to crawl into them and hack away with their little picks. Quickly, this set of economic interests realized that what they would have to do to keep their future secure was to draw the children out of the entire community and habit and attitude train them in schooling, and Prussia was the only working model.
You're listening to In Context on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and streaming live at WPKN.org. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. In today's program, we're looking at two important means of influencing public opinion in nominally democratic nations: compulsory schooling and mass media propaganda. Our guests are educator and author John Taylor Gatto and New York University media professor and author Mark Crispin Miller. This program will be archived for free listening on incontextreport.com, wpkn.org, and historycounts.org. So in 1852, Massachusetts adopted a compulsory education law, and you're right, the rest of the states followed eventually.
Well, but the eventually is the key word there. New York followed immediately. Washington, D.C. followed immediately, and that's it. 15 years passed, no one else followed. How did the break come where one by one the other states fell in line? Well, the key is that Washington, D.C. was on board, and as we know now, Washington has the ability to print as much money as it needs to lay bribes around for compliant states. So we didn't get the last state in line until 1918.
Well, there was considerable opposition to the notion of compulsory education.
There was an enormous opposition to it. In Massachusetts, at one juncture, children were marched to school at bayonet point. I mean, what was recognized at first is that productive human beings had to become unproductive. Kids whose successful lives were based on making multiple connections in the society were disconnected not only from opportunity, but from their own families, their own traditions, their own religions.
Yeah, you quote Elwood Cubberley, the dean of a Stanford School of Education, and he wrote, quote, "Each year the child is coming to belong more and more to the state and less to the parent." That was in 1909 in Conceptions of Education.
Yeah, Cubberley said in his doctoral thesis at University of Columbia that the new type of schooling would shape and fashion the young like nails so that, you know, they could be used in any industrial application. But he became the head of a national shadow organization called the Cleveland Conference. You can read about this in a very intellectual textbook called Managers of Virtue. The author is David Tyack, T-Y-A-C-K, and Cubberley took charge, once again, hold on to your hat, of every major administrative job in the United States, north, south, east, and west, and his shadowy Cleveland Conference would select, coming up through the ranks, those people willing to play ball with the new system of compulsory schooling that was intended to be the right arm, the strong right arm of government and corporate America.
How does it relate to the famous book Principles of Scientific Management by Frederick W. Taylor, published in 1911?
This idea that people were predictable machine parts was brought into industry by Frederick Taylor, who was a Prussian-trained social engineer. He invented what still exists called time and motion study. You must reduce the components of a system to a mathematically predictable conformity. So this became one of the major goals of the new institutional schooling. Now, parents weren't told this. You know, the bells just started to ring every 43 minutes. The standardized tests, which were intended to standardize, they have nothing to do with quality at all. I mean, it's a misapprehension to think the words high standards and standardizations are related to one another.
This came from Hugo Munsterberg from
Yes, Munsterberg at Harvard. But this was an international movement that eventually the United States took command of because we were so successful. I think the great irony is that our success was based on a kind of endless ingenuity, and this kind of a system destroys ingenuity, but because of the legacy of past generations, we still were immensely ingenious. So you only have to look at the steep drop in the number of patents attributed to Americans to realize what these decades of forced schooling have done to us. We've dropped from 90% of the world's total in 1939 to about 27% today, and the curve is steeply inclined downward.
You talked about the important role that John D. Rockefeller and Andrew Carnegie played in the evolution of the new system. One of the ways you point out is through founding places like Teachers College at Columbia, where they trained the future presidents of teacher colleges.
Well, not only Teachers College, I can give you Teachers College, Johns Hopkins, Yale University, University of Wisconsin, Stanford on the West Coast. All of these schools brought the German system to the United States. And because they had a great deal of prestige, because of the kind of families they recruited for their student body, other universities were really heavily influenced to follow suit. But Carnegie was not content to rely on the force of example. He and Rockefeller joined together in the early part of the 20th century and created a private organization called the General Education Board, and the General Education Board offered for the first time pensions to college teachers, but only if the college would adopt the Carnegie credit system, which was this rigid apportioning of so many hours spent with language, so many hours spent with number. I mean, it still exists, although it's somewhat weaker than it once was, so that in a short time, every place in the country, high schools couldn't get their kids in college unless they followed the Carnegie system. But even the majority of private schools assumed that this had been scientifically arrived at. It wasn't at all. It was based on a sophisticated understanding of how a small group can impose its will on a large group.
And this really ties in with the principles of secondary education by Alexander Inglis, which is make people more manageable.
Inglis was big time as you get, and as a consequence, nobody who thinks they know something about modern schooling has ever heard of Inglis. When Inglis gets to Harvard, Harvard names its honor lecture in education after Alexander Inglis, and it's still in existence and still called the Inglis Lecture. Inglis was also the head of Houghton Mifflin's secondary school publishing division, and by the way, the head of their elementary school publishing division was Elwood P. Coverley. So that was the major textbook producer back in the 1920s. And Inglis laid down in a book called Principles of Secondary Education the actual functions that schooling had to serve. I'll just throw a few of them out. One was you had to make everybody, whether so-called gifted and talented or a dummy, absolutely predictable, because business depended on being able to predict what color in fashion the ladies would wear that fall, etc., etc. And therefore, you had to rig the game by making people predictable, by getting rid of their independent opinion.
The idea of ranking people and dividing them by age, which was completely different from the Ben Franklin system, was something really important in the principles of secondary education.
Well, we're talking Julius Caesar here. What Caesar's Gallic Wars is about is how a small group of people can divide and conquer a large group of people by setting them against one another in petty competitions. That's what school structure is about. There's an infinite number of ways you make winners and losers and the mediocre.
How does that make it useful then to business?
Because it makes managers in charge the only thing that matters to underlings. A pat on the back, an extra dollar in the paycheck, an office on the shady side of the building. It makes management semi-godlike because your inner life is destroyed. You live to climb on the backs of who should be your natural allies. You've been divided from them. You've been divided from your family, divided from your religion, divided from your culture, divided from anyone who isn't exactly your same age or reading score in a standardized examination. You don't recover from that.
What are the implications of that system on how effective a democracy functions?
If people who are natural allies associate with one another and exercise their political franchise, they can, in fact, take over the system. So how can you seem to maintain a democratic structure, but in fact poison it at the root? Well, simply by dividing people against one another and putting them in constant competition with one another, it works to allow management to have its cake. Hey, we're a democracy, and eat it too.
Well, Congress did make findings which were very critical of big business control over education in 1913 and again in 1954 with the Reese Committee. Did anything come of these reports?
Nothing. The Walsh Committee and the other one was the Reese Commission. The Reese Commission, and it found the same things that Walsh did, that the policy of schools is decided inside of about 12 private corporate foundations like Rockefeller or Carnegie or these days Gates. And inside these foundations, decisions are made about what school kids will study and how many will be tracked into the corporate world and how many into the industrial, and so on and so on. Both these congressional investigations made those same discoveries, and nothing else happened except school enlarged its reach, its depth, the amount of money it removes from the purchasing power of the public for operation. Every time we've increased the amount of money we give schools, they get worse. If you say to yourself, wherever you are listening to this program, that everything I think I know about schooling is not true, everything I know about school is wrong, you'll be much better off than saying, well, I understand how this works.
Well, do you think it's feasible or practical to end compulsory schooling?
You can end it from the bottom up, because what ordinary parents think of as an education, in fact, can be mastered, can be taken on your own the way Ben Franklin did it and Franklin's friends did it.
You're listening to In Context on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming live at WPKN.org. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. In today's program, we're looking at two important means of influencing public opinion in nominally democratic countries, compulsory schooling and mass media propaganda. That was educator and author John Taylor Gatto discussing how the early American way of schooling, with its emphasis on family and self-education, was transformed during the Industrial Age into a highly institutionalized system of compulsory schooling. In the second part of this program, we discuss the techniques of mass media propaganda from its origins in World War I to modern times. Our discussion begins with my 2010 interview with Mark Crispin Miller, professor of media, culture, and communications at New York University, where he teaches a course on mass persuasion and propaganda. Professor Miller, thanks very much for being with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
I'd like to start with a quote from MIT professor Noam Chomsky, and I'd like your comments on it. He wrote in Media Control, "Propaganda is to democracy what the bludgeon is to a totalitarian state."
There's a lot of truth in that. Propaganda is the main means whereby the state, in an ostensible democracy, has its way with the people. This has really been the case for the last 100 years or so, most notably since World War I. You've got to master public opinion in order to do what you want to do, and the way to do that is to use propaganda.
One of the most important propagandists of the last century, Joseph Goebbels, said, in propaganda, truth should be used as frequently as possible.
Yeah. Joseph Goebbels was, you know, Hitler's minister of propaganda. He's the example that most often comes to mind when we talk about state propaganda at its most sinister and lurid. But he had various counterparts in the West. Even though American propaganda hasn't been as spectacular as Nazi propaganda, I think you could easily argue that the American government has relied as extensively on propaganda, especially over the last 10 years or so, as the Nazis did. Goebbels said a lot of quite brilliant things about propaganda. He noticed, for example, that the most effective propaganda is the kind that calls the least attention to itself. When you know you're being approached by a propagandist, when you know you're being addressed by someone with an ulterior motive, you're on your guard. Whereas if the propaganda seems almost as it were part of a natural environment, it's like the very air we breathe, and we don't quite notice it, we don't focus on it, it's all the more effective for that, because our guard is down. You know, now Goebbels would point to various kinds of film, public spectacle, torchlight parades, things like that. But we have, in the commercial sphere, product placement and stealth marketing and all sorts of other covert methods that, in their own way, are just as cynical and just as effective as the stuff the Nazis came up with. Goebbels was right about the use of the truth. Whenever possible, propaganda must be factually accurate.
Now, Hitler said the great masses of the people will more easily fall victims to a big lie than to a small lie. Why is that?
Well, that's a very famous theory of the big lies based on the assumption that people will be less inclined to doubt or resist an enormous lie precisely because it's hard to believe that anyone would tell a lie that big. And I think that's a perception that's extremely pertinent to the moment we're living in now.
Now, when we talk about propaganda in America, one of the intellectuals we have to talk about is Walter Lippmann, who wrote the book Public Opinion, published in 1922.
Right.
And he coined a term, the manufacture of consent.
Right.
What was Lippmann's thesis?
He had such a dark view of public reason that he believed that it was essential for the survival of democracy that there be a kind of caste of experts who are above politics and who would have the wisdom, to be blunt about it, to keep the people fooled, to direct public opinion in beneficial ways, manufacture consent, in short. This first became quite clear with the successful enterprise of the First World War. I mean, when we talk about propaganda, as we have been doing today, we tend to go immediately to the sort of grotesque and magnetic example of Joseph Goebbels and the Nazis. But the fact is that modern propaganda, whether it's commercial or political, had its root not in fascist Europe, but in England and America in the 19th century. Modern propaganda and advertising is simply a sphere of propaganda, were both basically Anglo-American creations, the late 19th century. The rise of this new science of propaganda, if we want to call it a science, coincided with the new interest in applied psychology for political effect. And one of the things that Lippmann understood the propagandist must do is to find the ways in which one might move people at an irrational level. Lippmann understood very, very keenly that the collective mind, the mind of the mob, if you want to call it that, is not a reasoning mind. It's not logical. That people en masse tend to be irrational. Now, I think that Lippmann takes this further than necessary. I think that his distrust of democracy is ultimately quite dangerous, but he makes a very compelling case in Public Opinion. Let's return to the example of the First World War.
Right.
Here we had a conflict of unprecedented violence that had to be sold to populations that had no particular reason to want to go to war at all. The Americans and the British were really disinclined to get involved in another war. How does one basically sell a conflict like this to people when the interests being served, in fact, are not the interests of the public? You know, it was basically an obscure imperialist rivalry.
That's when the Creel Commission comes in.
That's right. When we're talking about the United States.
Yes.
Woodrow Wilson appointed George Creel to be the head of the Committee on Public Information, which basically had the job of selling the war to the average American. And the obverse of this, of course, the necessary obverse of all propaganda is censorship. So the committee's job was twofold. It was, first of all, to sanitize the war and make sure that its true horror didn't register at home, and also to come up with a number of very stirring, purely emotional stimuli that would get people on board. What they did was they represented the Germans as Huns. They sort of rehabilitated this old Asiatic threat and very cleverly identified the Germans with the Huns of yesteryear and represented the whole conflict as a battle between barbarism and civilization. The British were the most prolific in coming up with atrocity stories that actually bore no relation to reality whatsoever. The Prussians were indeed quite brutal, but they didn't do any of the things they were accused of doing. They didn't crucify Allied soldiers. They didn't cut the breasts off of nurses and bat them back and forth with their butts of their rifles. They didn't impale babies on bayonets. The particular commission that came up with these stories had on it a number of very famous fiction writers and poets, people like Arthur Conan Doyle. I mean, this is the guy, you know, his Sherlock Holmes stories are beloved the world over. This guy really knows how to tell a story. People like him and like H.G. Wells and others were working for the government in a kind of literary capacity to invent these atrocity tales that would make the war almost irresistible.
Did they know the material for the stories weren't true?
See, I think at the very highest levels they had to know.
Do you think that the writers knew, or were they just fed
the material? It's very hard. That's the most interesting question about propaganda across the board, is the extent to which those who engage in it are themselves convinced of it. The fact is that 10 years after the war's conclusion, a very important book came out called Lies in Wartime. It was written by Lord Ponsonby, who was a socialist member of parliament. It was a short but very effective, very meticulous analysis of all the most notorious atrocity tales that had been used throughout the propaganda drive to get people on board. Ponsonby demonstrates in every case that the story was false, was made up. And this is something a lot of people had suspected, but Ponsonby let enough time go by that people were ready to hear the truth, and the book was an enormous bestseller both here and in Britain, and it did a tremendous amount to enlighten, some might say disillusion people, about what the truth really was. The reaction, after it became clear that the governments of Britain and the U.S. had really basically fooled people on a grand scale, the reaction was quite devastating. It was an enormous wave of anger and sort of cynicism. The lesson here is that, and then this is where Goebbels' point about using the truth comes into play, you have to be very careful as a propagandist not to lie so egregiously that the lies can then be exposed. Because once the lies are exposed, once people lose faith in a particular set of authorities, once the people see through a particular regime and that regime loses what we call its credibility, it's finished. There is no way to get it back.
Now, the Creole Commission had a lot of help. It was also known as the Committee on Public Information. Creole organized all sorts of aspects of our media to support him, the films, newspapers, publication division. As you mentioned, famous writers would work for him. The advertising industry had a board supporting him. Why do important people seem to be very willing to volunteer for an enterprise like that?
The whole media system jumped in quite enthusiastically to help out with this. People felt that it was their duty. There was a certain euphoria. I mean, let's face it. I mean, we know in our own time that the prospect of a righteous war really sets people on fire.
Walter Lippmann mentions that. He says, the citizen experiences a pleasurable emotion as he supports the foreign adventure.
Yeah, that's right. We've seen it in our own time. There are few feelings as, I don't know what to say, as overwhelming or as toxic as the feeling of committing oneself to a just national crusade.
And we all seem to enjoy the power, too. We join in it, even though we're not personally at risk.
You have a sense of power. You have a sense of impunity. You have a sense of righteous aggression. You have a sense of utter belonging. I mean, it's a brainless kind of an experience. You're surrendering your own reasoned mob, and it has the sanction of the whole establishment. It's quite something.
Creole also used front groups. Like, he had organizations called Friends of German Democracy and the League of Oppressed Nations. Why is a propagandist find those types of things useful?
Again, propaganda is that much more compelling when it seems not to be propaganda. If stuff comes directly from the government, it's going to be less impressive than stuff that seems to come from groups of citizens. Using front groups is a way to make the propaganda drive seem to come from everywhere. Everybody's on board.
You'd also mentioned censorship, and Lippmann said on that subject, without some form of censorship, propaganda is impossible. Is it necessary to have that backstop?
Well, yes. People often mistakenly use the word persuasion as a kind of synonym for propaganda. Propaganda is not persuasion. Persuasion involves argument. Persuasion involves dialogue. You and your adversary sort of hash it out. He or she has his or her counterarguments, and you address them, and you try to bring that person around to your way of thinking. Propaganda wants to obliterate. It wants all other points of view already to have been obliterated.
So it's fundamentally anti-democratic.
It's fundamentally anti-democratic. It's anti-rational. It wants not to persuade you. Rather, it wants to create a universe in which you would never even stop to think that there might be another way of looking at it. And this is exactly how state propaganda works. It does not want to engage in argument. It wants to create an entirely hermetic space where there is nothing but itself making its points over and over again. If you're allowed to hear from the other side, it's always the other side as concocted by the propagandists themselves. But no one can really break into this system. It's closed tight as a drum.
One of the most important propagandists to come out of World War I, perhaps the most important, was Edward Bernays. And in his book Propaganda, originally published in 1928, Bernays wrote, quote, "Those who manipulate the masses constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country. And propaganda is the executive arm of the invisible government." Could you talk about that?
Bernays is very, very heavily influenced by Lippmann, but he had far less ambivalence. He had no ambivalence whatsoever about the craft of propaganda, whereas Lippmann was at least mindful of the objections on democratic grounds. Bernays called himself the father of public relations, and indeed, he was probably the foremost practitioner of commercial propaganda out there. This isn't just advertising per se. Bernays was a brilliant man who understood that you don't sell things directly, but rather figure out how to manipulate circumstances so that you create desires without specifically trumpeting the virtues of a particular product. Let me give you an example. He was hired by a piano company to help improve the sales of pianos. This is sometime in the 20s. Well, what he did was he actually made a successful effort to popularize the idea of adding music rooms to private homes. You know, he did this by working with people in architectural magazines and so on. Created a fad for music rooms. Well, once you have created that fad and people are eager to build music rooms, it's only natural that piano companies will benefit, and in particular the piano company that had hired Bernays, because they could then take advantage of that new architectural innovation, standing ready to provide pianos that will fit perfectly in with this new decor.
So he had the patience to come at the problem indirectly and
exactly.
To nurture the demand.
He came at the problem indirectly. And the book Propaganda is very impressive. It is not in any sense a detached analysis of propaganda. It is actually a kind of sales brochure for Bernays' own services.
Although he was basically a commercial person, one of the groups he represented was United Fruit, which got him involved in a 1954 CIA coup in Guatemala against Arbenz.
That's right.
Can you talk about that?
Sure. This is where Bernays becomes extremely interesting. We spoke before about the difficulty of figuring out exactly how conscious the propagandist is of the spuriousness of his claims. Is he a self-conscious manipulator, knowingly telling lies? Or is he someone who, at some level, actually has persuaded himself that what he's saying is true? But if you go back and you look at his autobiography and read his chapter on his involvement with the United Fruit Company in Guatemala, you can see clearly that he was tremendously troubled by the fact that United Fruit and the CIA were simply destroying a democratic government.
His role would be to help place articles in prominent American media suggesting that the democratically elected head of Guatemala was a communist?
Yes. In this instance, he is a study in self-delusion.
And at the end of the operation, of course, Arbenz was undermined and forced out of power.
It set democracy in that country back decades and opened the door to a hideous series of bloody dictatorships. You know, it was a major crime against humanity, but he would never have been able to see it that way.
And of course, now in more recent events, and we see the use of many important propaganda techniques in the Persian Gulf War and in the Iraq War. In the 1980s, for example, Saddam Hussein was a strong ally of the United States and was portrayed very sympathetically in our media. And in 1990, he became worse than Hitler. How did George Bush Sr. do that?
This is a good example of how propaganda works. There were a number of inconvenient facts that stood in the way of marshaling broad mass American support of the first Gulf War. Amnesty International did a harrowing report on human rights abuses in Iraq in the 80s. Basically, this all happened without any media attention. The crucial fact is our government turned a deliberately blind eye to those atrocities. They wanted basically to play Iran and Iraq off against each other So they were arming Saddam Hussein. They were giving him all those weapons of mass destruction. There was an outfit called the U.S.-Iraq Business Forum that was put together in 1983 or 4, whose whole purpose was to promote profitable opportunities for the likes of Philip Morris and Xerox and Boeing and all the rest of them. It was basically a kind of a corporate effort to further warm relations between the U.S. and Iraq. It had the blessings of Donald Rumsfeld and people like that. All of that had to disappear down the memory hole when it came time to demonize Saddam Hussein for his invasion of Kuwait. The fact is, he was a bloodthirsty maniac. He had been one all along. It ultimately,
even when he was our friend. Yeah.
He was our maniac. In order for the propaganda to work, in 1990, especially leading up to the Gulf War of 1991, it was crucial to sanitize the record.
The media helped by just not talking about it, and then by giving a very big play to events such as that pseudo-congressional hearing with Tom Lantos. Could you talk about that? Because that's
one of the most astonishing things that the propaganda forces did. This is Hill and Knowlton was basically in charge of that whole interview.
They're a public relations firm?
Huge public relations firm that's been around for decades. Probably the biggest one in the world. They were hired by the Kuwaiti government in exile to do, in 1990, what Britain and the U.S. did in 1915, which is to sell a big war to a population that really wasn't interested in it. And the campaign, the atrocity drive against Saddam Hussein, was eerily similar to the drive to demonize Germany after it had invaded Belgium. The rape of Belgium is what they called the earlier event, and the rape of Kuwait is what they called the later event. And the similarities are many, and they are quite striking. What Hill and Knowlton did, among other many other things, was to coach the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States, have her testify in a congressional hearing about the notorious episode in which Iraqi troops took over a hospital in Kuwait City and emptied all these incubators that had newborn or premature babies in them. Her name was supposedly Nayira, and she testified very effectively, you know, tearfully, about having witnessed what these Iraqi troops did. And it was something like, I don't know, 32 incubators. They emptied them out on the floor. It was quite grotesque, quite gruesome. And everybody flipped out. This was exactly the kind of thing that a propagandist dreams of, because it was so hideous and seemed to be so unimpeachable that people were hollering themselves hoarse to use this as a reason for us to go in there and smash the Iraqis as soon as possible. Well, it turned out, according to John MacArthur, the publisher of Harper's Magazine, who wrote a book about the buildup to the war in 1991, that this was not just some little Kuwaiti girl who happened to be working in a hospital. She had not been in a hospital. She wasn't your average Kuwaiti teenager. She was the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States. She was a member of the family that ran the country. This whole performance was just that. It was a piece of theater. What she said happened never happened. Human rights observers of various kinds, you know, who went back and actually did take a look at what Saddam Hussein did do in Kuwait, could find no evidence that any of these incubators were emptied in this way. But many more people to this day have heard that Saddam Hussein's troops did this than have heard that it didn't happen.
The Iraq War, 2002, build up to 2003, the administration again used many important propaganda techniques. One I think is most effective is just the slogan, War on Terror.
Oh, yes. And of course, the attack on the World Trade Center.
And this idea of constantly associating whoever you don't like with that attack.
War propaganda is inevitably Manichaean in this way. It divides the universe into black and white. Good and evil.
So eventually, a majority of Americans believed that Saddam Hussein participated in the attack on the World Trade Center.
Well, yeah, for a while there, I think some 60-some percent of the American people believed there was a link between Saddam Hussein and the attack on 9/11.
And again, as in World War I, you frame the debate in terms you can't lose. Support the troops. I guess that means if you oppose the policy, then you obviously don't like the troops.
Right. That's
if you
exactly
oppose
right.
the policy, you're in favor of terrorists.
That's right.
You also mentioned that Orwellian newspeak, you discussed that in the film, was used frequently in the war. Things like, I guess, Operation Iraqi Freedom would be an example.
Yeah. The Bush administration necessarily made us rethink Orwell because all those tactics, those perverse tactics, calling things by the opposite of what they are. War is peace, freedom is slavery. I mean, we used to think of that kind of thing as purely satiric, a kind of exaggeration of what went on in places like Nazi Germany or Soviet Russia. But now it's obvious that this kind of thing can go on here and now in an ostensibly free country with an ostensibly free press. Now it is routine for programs to be called by the opposite of their proper names.
The Clean Skies Act, for
Clean
example.
Clean Skies Initiative, Healthy Forests.
No Child Left Behind.
No Child Left Behind.
You can't win these arguments.
No, you can't. If you use their language, you've already succumbed to their agenda. It was obvious they never intended not to invade Iraq. You know, they basically flipped from rationale to rationale with a kind of dizzying speed that, you know, a truly democratic media system would have pointed out. But here, the mainstream, the so-called liberal media, was completely complicit in this.
The performance, the media, and the current war does relate to the issue of a concentration of media ownership, doesn't
it? Yes, absolutely.
You quote, I believe it's Joseph Goebbels in the film Orwell Rules in His Grave, where he said, "What you want in a media system is ostensible diversity that conceals an actual uniformity."
Yeah, that's a quote of Goebbels'. Another chillingly prescient quote. The Nazis' propaganda was not highly dogmatic, explicitly anti-Semitic, party drivel that everybody was force-fed day after day. The daily media diet that people took in under the Nazis was not all that different from ours. There's a lot of fluff, a lot of human interest, a lot of detective magazines, crime stories. Only a small minority of the films that Goebbels produced were outright Nazi propaganda films, because people shied away from that sort of thing.
We have a number of different networks. Why is it when you turn the dial, they're often covering the same story and giving you the same perspective?
The news serves a function absolutely antithetical to the function of propaganda. The two ought to be, ideally speaking, complete opposite. Our news divisions now are simply one small part of a much larger machine, a much larger media cartel. We're talking about five or so parent companies, and all they really want to do is make as much money as possible. They're only thinking about the stock price. Plus, they're in business with each other. They're not mere competitors. They have all kinds of strategic partnerships. They own stock in each other's parent firms. So it's really them and the government against the people. This is exactly the opposite of what the framers had in mind when they wrote the First Amendment.
Is there a self-correcting mechanism in our system that can restore power to the people?
Well, there's not a self-correcting mechanism. What we need is to return to the principles of the First Amendment. The press that the framers had in mind when they drafted the First Amendment bore no relation to the media industry we have today. The idea that, you know, highly capitalized commercial firms would be providing people with news, the likes of General Electric and Disney would be in charge of the media. This would have appalled and mystified the framers. Back in their day, the press was basically any citizen who could afford to set up a printing press and start publishing a newspaper. The blogosphere of today is far closer to the press of the 18th century than the so-called media. So the only way that we're going to rectify the situation and to democratize the press in this country again is through radical media reform. We have got to break down these cartels. We've got to re-regulate the broadcast media. We have a tremendous amount of work to do to reverse the damage that's been done to the press, first by Reagan and then by Clinton. It was they who did the most to corporatize the media and enable this nonstop consolidation. There's no self-correcting mechanism aside from the willingness and commitment of the people to insist on change, because it's only when the government fears its people that it will listen to them.
You've been listening to In Context on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming live at WPKN.org. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. In today's program, we examined two important means of influencing public opinion in nominally democratic countries, the schooling system and mass media. This program will be archived for free listening on incontextreport.com, wpkn.org, and historycounts.org. In Context is produced by MDR Productions, Inc. Our website is incontextreport.com. Check us out on Facebook and see our videos on our YouTube channel, In Context Radio and TV. and you can contact us through Facebook, Twitter, or email me directly at ken@mdrtalk.org. Thanks for joining us.